Hello, and welcome to our Secular Overeaters podcast series, where you'll hear from speakers who have found recovery from food and other addictions without God. For additional information, go to secularovereaters.org. And now let's get to today's podcast.
It's now my great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Jeffrey Munn. Jeffrey is a licensed psychotherapist located in California. He is the author of Staying Sober Without God, The Practical 12 Steps to Long-Term Recovery from Alcoholism and Addictions. He has worked with addicts both in and out of 12-step programs for 15 years and is himself an active member of the recovery community. Jeffrey will speak for 30 minutes and then we'll have questions. We're absolutely thrilled to have you here, and go ahead and take it away.
Thanks so much. Thank you for inviting me to speak. I am grateful to be able to participate and contribute to my own recovery and anyone else's recovery in any way possible. I guess I'll start with what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And for me, this is, I did not go to many OA meetings, although I will say food has and continues to be a constant source of comfort seeking for me. And I have gone back and forth with it all my life, really. And it's, you know, I think I would very much qualify for this program. So I relate to a lot of what I hear when I do come to these meetings. For me, my primary addiction was drugs and alcohol. And I started using pretty late in life, but I knew that I was an addict because I was craving alcohol and drugs before I had ever tried them, you know. And I've heard some people describe alcoholism and addiction as this invisible line that's crossed at some point due to the use of the substance or whatever addictive thing is being used. And that wasn't really the case for me. There was a component of that, but for the most part, I mean, I wanted to escape right away. And when I found out that alcohol and other drugs could make me feel different, I was like, oh, I'm all about that. Feeling different sounds like an excellent thing. And so I sought that wherever I could. And, you know, I suppose one of the ways I was fortunate was that my addiction didn't go very powerfully into any one hard drug. It just was whatever would get me out of where I was currently. But when I started, I really went for it. I didn't want to just feel a little bit different. I didn't want to just take the edge off. I wanted to be in an alternate reality. And so I did that. I did that for a very long time, for not a very long time. But I was such a profoundly low functioning addict that luckily I hit bottom pretty quick. I mean, I would quit jobs so I would have more time to use. And I was very, very low functioning addict. Couldn't leave the house. And, to an extent, I'm actually very grateful for that because it woke me up really early, and I realized I cannot do this. And one of the things that I always mention when I speak at meetings, and especially when I speak at meetings that I've been invited to because of my book, is I do not view myself as someone who's an authority on other people's addiction in general, necessarily. I think I know more than some because I have both my own personal experience as well as clinical experience. But a lot of my own recovery, I think, was due to privilege and luck and things that, you know, I did not author myself. For example, I, in a different set of circumstances, I may very well be dead or in jail right now. You know, I was fortunate to have a family with some means to get me into rehab and programs and things like that. And a lot, if not most people, don't have those resources. And I understand that. And so there's no, you know, I always want to make sure early on that I'm not giving anyone the impression that like, I did it. So why can't you? Like, I understand people are in very different situations. And for those of you who have read my book, I hope to make it very clear in there that it's a very individual thing. And what I write about in the book is what I did and my interpretation of the program that makes sense to me. I do not bash any approaches to recovery that work. And I do not claim that my recovery approach will work for everybody. There are no guarantees in there. It's just if this approach speaks to you, if my experience speaks to you, and gives you some strength and hope and helps you recover, awesome. If it doesn't, I am so okay with finding something else. So luckily I hit bottom pretty quickly. The first time I hit sort of my, and when I say I hit bottom, it, for me, that's an emotional, that's an internal thing. What rock bottom looked like for me was would not make a great TV show. It was not very exciting. You know, there was no arrests. It's very hard to get arrested if you don't leave the house. There were no arrests, no major medical incidents or anything like that, other than a chemical burn due to, you know, smoking hard drugs and things like that. But, really very uneventful. It was an emotional bottom. It was a internal state of like, I this is not going to work anymore. It was the tipping point where the pain of the addiction had finally outweighed the anticipated pain of finding a different lifestyle. And so I got sober through meetings first, but I was very much one of those like, oh no, I'm only here for this one drug because this was the drug that, you know, this was the drug behavior that caused me the most problems. So this is the problem. You know, I didn't quite yet understand that all of my addictions and addictive behaviors really had a common root. And so, you know, I went about a year and a half not using drugs, but, you know, eating, you know, my own, you know, sex and love addiction stuff and all stuff that is technically outside issues for this meeting. So I apologize if it's crossing a boundary for anybody, but it's part of my story. And so after about a year and a half, I was like, well, maybe I can just do X, Y, and Z and, you know, and not do my main addictive stuff and I'll be fine. And I did. And it was a very, very short period of time before I was back to doing what I was doing before. And at that point I realized, okay, all right, my addiction is my addiction. It's this many-headed beast that, you know, once it's awakened, it's there. And it's dictating my life. And so that this time I was fortunate enough to be able to go to an inpatient rehab. And luckily this place had some incredible therapists. And that was when I decided I wanted to become a therapist because I saw these individuals in action and talking about things that I didn't even know could be talked about. You know, learning how to articulate my own feelings, my own experiences, my own needs in ways that I never learned before. Certainly didn't learn from my parents. Also did not learn much about it in meetings, although, you know, it depends on the meeting and everything. So I don't want to knock meetings, but it was a new level of sort of awareness of my emotional life, how my feelings and my thoughts impact my behaviors. And so I decided that I wanted to become a therapist. And I was about 2 years sober. I decided I'm going to try and become a therapist. And so I went to school and I did all that. And I was privileged with the opportunity to be in 12-step meetings and also be in therapy and also be becoming a therapist. So I kind of was able to see it from a lot of different angles. And I have been a lifelong agnostic, at least. But, you know, when I first started attending 12-step meetings, I really wanted to give the God thing a try. Everyone was doing it. I clearly am prone to peer pressure. And so I'm like, okay, all right, you guys say there's something to this. I'm going to do it. I'm going to try. I'm going to hit my knees in the morning. I'm going to do all the things. And I did. And I won't say I saw no benefit from it. I think there is something just emotionally satisfying about starting your day off with some sort of reflection or, you know, stating of intentions, things like that. I actually like the idea of prayer a lot. I just no longer am trying to force myself to believe that there's some entity that's listening and then will directly intervene in my life if I do it right. I lost my train of thought. I wanted to do the God thing at first. And the phrase that I use is it just felt like I was trying to shoehorn it into my recovery. The more I tried to do it, the more it felt like just something that wasn't natural to me, that didn't make sense to me. And I was trying to force it into my program because it was supposed to be there. You know, everyone's telling me that this is supposed to be part of your program. And not only that, but it's an essential part of my program. And if I don't do this, I'm going to die. And, you know, so there's a lot of pressure to take a faith-based approach. And, but it just wasn't helpful for me. But I saw that it was helpful for a lot of other people. And I had my own beliefs about why that was, because to me, on a psychological level, a lot of what people were describing as spiritual experiences and the results of prayer and meditation and things like that, a lot of them made sense to me through a psychological lens. You know, I was able to see, I was able in my own head to kind of interpret these things and be like, okay, well, when you're experiencing this, I mean, I've experienced something like that before, but for me, it was, you know, my understanding of what it was that I was feeling connected to something bigger than myself. I don't think it was that someone was actually, you know, reaching down and making me feel something or anything like that. So I just saw it through, I was able to, for my own sanity in the program, I was able to translate a lot of what I was hearing into secular language for myself. And it's all made sense. And I started to find that, you know, not believing in God was not a deal breaker for the program. I could not believe in, you know, a Abrahamic Judeo-Christian God and still get a lot out of meetings and get a lot out of recovery and still work the steps and still do, you know, what I needed to do to get well. And, you know, I just sort of, I was thinking about it all the time when I was in meetings. And I feel like this book just sort of, the book that I wrote was just sort of written before, you know, before I had ever written it. It just needed to get out onto paper because this is stuff I'd been thinking about and kind of translating in my own head for a long time. And really the biggest compliment that I get about the book is when people say like, oh, you just made it make sense, which was entirely, that was my whole point, is I wanted it to just make sense for somebody who didn't share that worldview of there being a supreme being that's interacting with us. And so I've been able to maintain a good amount of recovery and sobriety. The food thing is still it's still a constant battle. I have my moments where I do well with it. I have moments where, you know, my wife is also recovering, and she is in OA, and we both sometimes have, you know, mutual relapses, which is very tough if one's partner is not on the exact same, you know, wavelength as you, as I'm sure some of you have experienced. So that's still been a bit of a struggle, and I still seek ways to escape. And so I'm by no means completely free of any addictive behavior. And I'm not sure I've met anybody who is, but if you are, please come talk to me after the meeting. I'd be fascinated to meet you. You know, I still self-soothe in ways, but I'm not destroying my life. You know, I have a beautiful daughter, and, I have a marriage that I feel is, you know, an extremely healthy relationship, and we make good partners and run the household well together, and also have actual human connection and intimacy, which was something I was never good at before. And, you know, so I feel like it's really been I've benefited a lot from a secular approach to recovery. And so I do know that if I can, then other people might be able to, maybe not everybody, but, you know, that was proof to me that it was possible. And that's what gave me the confidence to write about it and actually share that with other people, because as you may continue to discover, especially during like the Q&A, I don't like to speak in absolutes. Generally speaking, I don't like to speak in absolutes. I like to, you know, I don't like to make claims unless I'm absolutely sure they're true. And so, you know, when I found out for myself that I could do this without believing in God, I was like, okay, that means it is possible. And that's all I'm going to say in my book. That's the only thing I have proof of right now, is that it happened for me, so it's possible. And it's very unlikely that I'm the only person on the planet that this approach is going to work for. So it's going to work for some people, I think. And that was enough of a reason to write about it. And so that's where the book came from. And it's been really just, you know, incredible to see people resonate with it and read it, and, you know, read back sentences that I wrote to me, and, you know, and say like, this made a lot of sense. And that's just the best compliment that I can get, is that it makes sense. 'Cause that's what I needed. I'm a very concrete, very literal analytic type person. And there was a big push in program to deny that part of myself. And I'm sure many of you have heard at some point the phrase, you're too smart for your own good, or you can be too smart for your own good in program. And I just hated that. I mean, I think it's natural to hate that, but I really hated it. I was like, no, that doesn't make it's not bad to be smart. I think what's bad is to be maybe arrogantly smart, or to be closed-minded and, you know, not open to new information. But I wanted to find a way that I could integrate my understanding of the world with also just my emotional and, you know, mental, the changes that need to occur in recovery, if that makes sense. And so, you know, I'm grateful that I get to talk to people about this stuff. I really don't like talking about myself. I've always been bad. Whenever somebody invites me to share, I'm always just like, can we just do Q&A? I love Q&A. I can answer questions all day long. I just have to sit and talk about myself, it just feels so icky. And, you know, it's like my humility and my narcissism are fighting with each other, and it's just it's just weird. So anyway, that's my story. Again, not super exciting. It was all just sort of an internal journey to finding a version of recovery that made sense to me and worked for me and was sustainable. Something where I didn't feel like I was being inauthentic, because that eventually led to burnout. You know, if I was forcing myself to sort of recover in a way that other people were recovering but didn't feel authentic to me, I would eventually grow resentful. And I would eventually stop attending meetings, or I would get really like, just, I would be the one in meetings just like scoffing and rolling my eyes and stuff like that. And now I still roll my eyes occasionally at meetings, but you know, it's much easier for me to be like, okay, that's their cool. Like, it's fine. That's their thing, because I'm okay. I have learned to accept that my approach is okay for me, you know? And sure, it helps when other people are like, hey, I'm doing it too, and it works for me. Yeah, that's great validation. But what I really need is to look at my own life and see that it's born fruit. Is that the right word? It's bared, born, whatever. I gave me fruit. Anyway, that's pretty much all I have for the sharing portion. I don't know. How did I do? How long did I go?
That was about 20 minutes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Good job.
Two thirds. Not
and,
bad.
You have an opportunity, if you want to talk about your book and the contents of your book and maybe how it's structured or how you think people might be able to use it. Or if you'd like, we can go straight into question and answer.
Yeah, I could talk about that. I mean, I don't know. I haven't met any of you, so I'm not sure who has read my book, who hasn't. I don't know. Oh, I love it. And holding up a copy of my book. That's still a very surreal experience. So you know what's funny, though, too, is every time I do one of these talks, people want me to sort of walk through the steps, and I need to see the steps because I haven't memorized my own steps, because I haven't gone to meetings where they're reading them. I realized going to meetings and having the steps read over and over was so important for remembering the steps, because I haven't even memorized my own steps. I have a general idea of what each one stands for, what the wording is, but I'll miss words here and there and everything. So I probably need to get a copy of my book, but just generally speaking, I'm not going to go through each step, you know, verbatim and everything, but you know, generally speaking, I wanted to, rather than just rewriting the steps without God in it, I wanted to try and identify the psychological process that was going on and put that into simple terms and replace God with that in there. So for example, you know, step three is the most gaudy of the steps, in my opinion, or at least one of the most. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. I mean, that's 100% God. It's, you're just giving everything to God. So it's that was one of the more challenging steps to secularize. And I was like, what's going on there? And I realized that one of the things we always talk about in therapy and it's talked about in meetings too, it's the serenity prayer. But one of the things that always is talked about in therapy and just in general psychology and self-care is the ability to let go of things that you can't control, is acceptance. And there's, you know, if any of you have been in therapy or recently or are currently in therapy, you may know that there's this third wave of therapy that's very intensely focused on mindfulness, radical acceptance, being present. It's very sort of Buddhist in nature without any of the supernatural stuff. And it's just so crucial. And I feel like that was a big part of step three was, okay, I'm going to do this. It's a commitment. I'm going to do this work and I'm going to let go of what I can't control. I'm going to just focus on my own side of the street. I'm just going to focus on doing the step, doing, you know, putting in the footwork, doing the steps, And what I can't control is none of my business. And that to me felt like, you know, for me, felt like an adequate secular way to phrase that we're turning our will and our lives over to the care of God. We're giving ourselves to the process and letting go of trying to control things that we can't control, because that leads to, you know, insanity and stress and everything bad. A lot of the steps are very much the same, just maybe simplified a little bit. Like, we, you know, writing lists. One of the things that I changed was in step four, they have you write a separate list for sexual harms, which I felt was a little bit archaic. I mean, it almost reinforces the shame around sexual behavior to make it a separate list. Like, it's this, like, oh, then we wrote the sex list. And it's like, our harms are our harms, and it's important to include sexual behaviors in our harms, but I didn't want to make that a whole separate thing that you put over here and lock in a safe and hide in your wall. So there's that. And then, you know, a big focus of my book and all that is, and my steps is surrounding yourself with healthy people. I absolutely 100% still think that the 12-step programs are the place to go for finding like-minded people and for finding support. And, you know, so I never encourage people to not go to meetings. I would never, ever, ever do that. And many of the negative reviews I've gotten on Amazon, you know, it's people reading the title of the book and completely misunderstanding what it means. You know, I've had many people reach out to me and say, oh, so you think you can just get sober by yourself, huh? And I said, no, I don't. I mean, is it possible? Again, I don't generally like to speak in absolutes. I'm sure somebody's done it. I'm sure it's been done. It's not an approach I would recommend. I didn't do it. I don't think I could have. But no, absolutely not alone. I think we are social creatures, and we, you know, our lives change depending on who we surround ourselves with. And if we surround ourselves with healthy people that are working towards managing emotions better and building real intimate connections with each other, I think that's essential. I think that's huge. So that's a big emphasis in my steps. And then acceptance is a huge one. You know, for step 11, I was torn on whether to include prayer, because I do believe in the power of prayer. I just don't believe that there is anything supernatural going on. I think that, you know, if I wake up in the morning and I say, you know, may I be well today, may my family be well, all that kind of stuff, it has an impact on how I feel, and it helps, it affects my focus. It grounds me a little bit. So I think it's a good practice, and I think it's helpful. But I didn't include it in the steps that I wrote because I was just too concerned, like, especially because it's step 11, you know, people have gotten almost all the way through the book, and then they're like, ah, he was doing so well, and then he mentioned prayer. You know, so I didn't include it in there because I feel like it's too nuanced, and, you know, maybe I'll put it in there in some capacity in the next version or something, but it's really just meditation. I have found meditation to be one of the most powerful tools for me, specifically mindfulness meditation. And I don't do it nearly as often as I should, but, you know, the practice of it, in my experience, nearly all of my, I want to say all, but again, I'm trying to not speak in absolutes. Nearly all of my self-soothing, addictive type behaviors have just come from some sort of deficit in my ability to regulate my emotions, you know, or be okay with unregulated emotions, or sit with unregulated emotions. You know, so not just my ability to make myself feel better if I'm feeling poorly, but to be able to just feel sad, angry, lonely, anxious and just feel it and not immediately need to make it go away, to sort of desensitize myself to the fear that comes up when I'm uncomfortable. You know, there's a fear that I have when I feel discomfort that this is never going to go away. I'm going to feel, if I feel this way and I don't make it go away, it's never going to go away. And the practice of just being able to feel it and to know that it's transient, is huge. So yeah. And then, you know, step 12, I talk about, just teaching other people, just passing it along, which I still think is one of the most helpful parts of recovery, is being of service in some way. I have a whole bunch to say about sponsorship and stuff like that. I won't get into that right now. If anyone wants to ask me about it, I'm happy to get on my soapbox about all that. And I would say probably another one of the biggest changes that I made in my own approach to the program and put in the book was the step 6 and 7, which was initially just a very, very passive sort of thing. Or at least if you read it right out of the big book, it appears passive. People have added more to it and made it more of an active process. But in the original, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous 12 step book, it was very passive. It was you ask, you get ready, and then you ask God to remove your character defects. And I have that be sort of a much more cognitive behavioral type interactive process. And I'm happy to talk about that more for anyone who's interested. But yeah, that was a jumbled mess of a description of my book, but
actually that was great. And that's a good segue now into, questions and answers. And, if you want, I could share a screenshot of the steps, but let's go into questions and answers. And we'll start with Salem, who has his hands up.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you, as always, for your wisdom. Let me ask you this. You've been in several addictions. What do you think of the premise that food addiction has a special twist because we do have to face the substance in some way or another each day? And I've sometimes heard AA people say, you know, OA is a kind of a graduate school because of this challenge. What do you think of that?
I'd absolutely agree with that. I mean, I think every addiction has its own special twist, and you know, I think everything's a little bit different, and you know, everyone's constellation of addictions and things that sort of press their dopamine button is a little different. And, you know, I've met people in, you know, sex and love addiction meetings who, you know, have zero problems with drugs and alcohol. And then I've met people who do. It's so individual and it's so unique to everybody. But yeah, the eating stuff is so, so hard because you have to eat. You have to eat. And it's about finding a balance in something that we're naturally not good at self-regulating. You know, we don't have that thing that normies have where they can just be like, I have eaten enough. I'm done. And my body has what it needs and I'm going to stop. So I feel like that's a big part of it. And all of the addictions or compulsive behaviors, I should say, even, you know, codependency, we need relationships. You know, it's a more nuanced thing. It's not black and white. And yeah, stuff like alcohol and drugs is a little bit easier in that, or I should say simpler in that regard, in that it is pretty black and white, right? It's like you don't drink, you don't use. But no, it's different. It's different with the behavioral addictions, for sure.
Thank you. And I failed to introduce myself as a food and volume addict. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Welcome.
Jenny, you're up next.
Hi, Jeffrey. Hi, everybody. Hi. Jenny, sugar addict and compulsive eater. And I have not read your entire book yet, but I have it. And when I read 12-step books, I like to read the chapters as I'm working that particular step. And I have five different books, kind of the secular bent that I will read next time I go through the steps. And I just have to say, one thing I really like is that these chapters are short, and it's like you get to the point, it's easy to digest, and I just really appreciate that. I did recently read Step 10 because I'm in this alternative step group, and this was the step of the month, and I just really liked some of the practical stuff you had in there. Like one of the things you said was, next time you get into an argument with a coworker, friend, or family member, practice acknowledging your part in the conflict. And that is just like such a basic thing, you know, and it's like, it's good to be reminded of a lot of those kinds of things. I also liked, so I did read like the stuff at the back because it was new to me, talking about relapse, and lapsing. And in OA, most people talk about lapses as slips. And then we also have relapses. And so I enjoyed reading about that. And also I like the extra tools that you added, which I also feel like that OA has 9 tools, and it would be really great if they added some of the ones you talked about, like exercise, nutrition, sleep, fun, and communication. I think that those were all good. So even though I haven't read the entire book, I read like the parts that are really new to me. And next time I do the steps, I'm definitely going to use your book. And also when I was going online, I noticed that there is a companion workbook that looks like it's just like a document, and it looks like it's free, but it has, I mean, that's really great. It said something about how you were involved in it, but I don't know. But it's always great to have a workbook to try out when you're working the steps.
Yeah, I am very slowly working on the workbook. That workbook was written by somebody else. She did seek permission from me to write it, and to my understanding is not profiting off of it, which also wouldn't bother me that much. But no, if you're finding that helpful, that's awesome. But I do have one in the works, and I'm hoping to finish it eventually.
Cool. Yeah. She's not, it doesn't seem to be for profit. It's just there to download if you want. But anyway, thanks. Thank you so much for speaking today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jenny. Rob, you're up next.
Thanks, Melissa. And thank you, Jeffrey, for coming today. We really appreciate your time. You mentioned something about sponsorship, and I wondered if you wanted to say a few more words about your thoughts on that.
Yeah. When it comes to sponsorship, I think it's really important to acknowledge the fact that not everybody is cut out to be a sponsor. And I think there needs to be some really clear boundaries around sponsorship and what it is and what's expected and what is, you know, in my opinion, a sponsor is somebody who has worked a program that has worked for them, and they show you how they did it. And that's it. A sponsor is not somebody who tells you when you can start dating. A sponsor is not somebody who tells you what to do about your mental health conditions. A sponsor is not somebody who tells you what groceries to buy. They're just the boundaries get way too blurry. I think people, you know, and I get it. Someone's entering recovery and they're feeling a ton better, and they feel like they've found the secret to life, and they feel like they can opine on every aspect of this person's life who's coming to them. And I think there are a lot of people that just are not cut out to be sponsors, shouldn't be sponsors, and that's okay. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with them. It's a very unique skill to be able to hear someone's story, know when to talk. I'm obviously biased because as a therapist, this is what is drilled into our heads, is how, you know, it's not just what you say, it's what you don't say. It's what you let the other person figure out and, you know, discover for themselves. And it's not easy. And there are a lot of therapists who have become therapists and have been doing therapists for 20 years who have no business doing therapy, in my opinion. You know, so it's a unique skill. And if you don't have it, that's okay. And you can be of service and you can help people in a lot of other ways. But I feel like sponsorship is too much right now. It's too unclear what it means and what the boundaries should be around it. And I think a lot of people, especially people early in recovery, can have some really unfortunate experiences with sponsors who are overconfident in their own credentials. And Yeah. So I that's my opinion on it. And, you know, if you have an experience getting sober and it worked for you, share that, you know, share, because that's the one thing you can never be wrong about, really, is what did I do and what do I, and how do I think it helped me? That you stick with that. That's great. And that can change, still change lives and be very helpful. And just listening, learning how to listen and just be there for someone else. And, oh, I hear you're going through this, and that's huge. And so, you know, I wish we had a sponsored training program, but that would just be, guys, no way to make that happen. But yeah, that's my two cents.
Great. Thank you so much. Alan, you're up next.
I'm Alan, a recovering food addict. Thanks for sharing, Jeff. I think it's the second time I've heard you at one of these things. You know, one of the things you said that really stuck with me is that the essence of addiction is having an emotional state that's uncomfortable and a fear that it'll never go away. So the only thing I know how to do is comfort it with food or alcohol or behavior. And the essence of recovery is learning to self-soothe, to manage my emotional states without having to pick up in any form. When you said that, I thought of the concept of emotional intelligence, which essentially is like identifying, this is my feeling, two, learning to sort of manage it internally, and then three, learning to manage it within a social context, because often these emotions damage relationships. I wonder if you could just kind of speak to emotional intelligence and the role it plays in recovery.
It's a critical skill, and it's one of the things that I found to be probably the most dismissed in meetings, because I, you know, and obviously, you know, I'm hearing what I'm hearing, and, you know, other people may have heard different things, and, you know, I'm hearing the things that sound wrong to me and maybe missing other people who are saying the right thing, but get out of self, right? Get out of yourself. And that certainly, in my opinion, has a place. And there are absolutely times that I can become far too self-obsessed. But I think that can be misunderstood to mean that any sort of self, that like getting to know yourself and taking your emotional reaction to life seriously doesn't mean believing it, but taking it seriously and validating your own feelings and learning what they mean about you and the way that you relate to the world is so important. And, you know, sometimes when people are in a place where they're really introspective and, you know, they're, you know, trying to learn more about their emotions and what makes them tick, and someone says to them, you know, get out of yourself, I think that's doing them a disservice. So yeah, the emotional intelligence, the emotional awareness, that's again where I think mindfulness comes in too, is just watching. It's this watching of your internal experience without judgment, without trying to change it, so that you can gain more insight. I love the phrase, you know, sort of becoming a connoisseur of your neuroses. You just get to know your own stuff really well, and that absolutely helps you navigate it. And so I think it's a critical skill for every human being on the planet to be able to identify emotions that are arising, and to know how to, you know, respond to them and manage them, not necessarily make them go away, but to manage them. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Georgie, you're up next.
Thank you. Hi, Georgie, compulsive overeater. Thank you, Jeffrey, for joining us. I had two quick questions. The first was, as you said, a fellow addict in recovery, was there any one book or piece of literature that was pivotal to your recovery that you could recommend today? And then the second question I have is around, I wondered if you had any opinions on, when it comes to, some 12-step fellowships can be very, very strict when it comes to abstinence. And say, for example, you know, unless you have 30 days of abstinence, you can't chair a meeting, or you can't even put out chairs, and you have to like sit at the back and be quiet. And so did you have an opinion on, do you think that encourages sobriety and abstinence, or do you think that could do more harm than good? I'd be really interested to know your thoughts.
Good questions. In terms of books that I used, really, I'd say one of the most eye-opening books for me was the book by Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now. That was the first sort of introduction into like this idea that, you know, just pure awareness and mindfulness and presence in itself can be a healing thing. You know, I'll take some of what he says and leave the rest. Now, I think he can be a mixed bag, but that book kind of opened the doorway for me to look at that. And then there's another, I mean, it depends on what kind of books you like to read and stuff like that. There's one called Buddha's Brain, which really goes into the details of through mindfulness meditation and contemplative sort of practices, what happens in the brain, the long-term changes, things like that, which I think is, again, it's science-based and it's like, oh, look, this is backed by research that if I do this, it will, you know, that's the kind of stuff I like and need in my recovery. When it comes to the really strict meetings, I have a lot of feelings about it. I have mixed feelings. You know, I've met people who, you know, I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with Pacific Group. You know, I've met people in Pacific Group, which is like, from what I know, one of the most strict. You know, and I've met people in CEA Howe, who, you know, that's got a lot more structure and stuff. And I think it works for some people. You know, by our nature in active addiction, we tend to lack structure and boundaries and regularity. And I think having that in a meeting or having that in a program can be really beneficial to people, and it can give them a sense of stability and a sense of purpose and a sense of regularity and predictability and stuff like that. So I think that's good in a way, but I also think it can be overdone, and, you know, I think it can cause harm too. Whether it causes more harm than good, I don't know. When a meeting is telling you, just making a blanket statement about antidepressants and saying you don't need antidepressants.
Papa, what are you doing, Papa? He's on the phone. So
what was I saying? I'm very easily distracted. This is my ADD.
Antidepressants.
Thank you. So, you know, if a meeting's telling you what medication to take, that's a big problem. I don't agree with that even remotely. You know, so I think it's about a balance. It's about finding a balance. And it's also individual. I think there are some people that respond well to structure and a strict approach. And then there are people like me who, as soon as you tell me what to do, I bristle and I'm like, oh, no. Listen to me, hear me out, give me your feedback, couch it in, take this if you'd like it, don't take it if you don't want it. Don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what has to happen. Don't tell me what is absolutely true in my life. You know, that just drives me absolutely bonkers. But it works for some people, and that's okay, and that's fine. So
thank you.
And Jim, you're up with a question.
Well, two things, just to comment. I just found Secular Coda in the last week, Codependence, and I just we had to talk, Jeffrey, about how you might, and they've got your steps on the front page of their website. So we had to think about how to make you an organizing point for all of these other fellowships. But the point I stuck in the chat, I'll say it again, is I had heard that you really aren't particularly wed to the 12 steps as the number 12. I found it a very helpful way for personal growth, but I think it's just one of many. And there are a lot of people in our fellowship who they treat the 12 steps almost the way other people treat the deity. And I think, and I'd just like to hear you sort of speak to, you know, how important the number 12 is in these particular 12 ways of having a better life.
Not at all. The reason I did 12 was because, there is a 12-step program, and I wanted it to mirror that enough so that people felt like they could do the two together, right? Like they could bring my book to meetings and it would help them through the same program. And if it's like, you know, if I merge step, you know, 6 and 7, then it's going to be all weird. And so it's really just more about giving people who are already in 12-step programs a sense that like this is compatible with what they're doing. They don't need to leave their meetings or anything to work, you know, the program mm-hmm. through my book. That's the only reason for it. I think you could rewrite, depending on how you word it, I think you could rewrite, you know, the recovery process in, you know, 24 steps. I think you could do it in, you know, 3 phases. I think you could do it I think there's a lot of different ways you could frame it. So I don't think the number 12, I don't find that to be sacred in any way.
I think it did come from a sacred text, actually.
Well, no, I mean, I don't personally find it like, it's not sacred to me, but yes, yeah. I know there's, and that was, you know, part of a concern too, is like, I don't want it to, you know, seem like I'm advocating that or anything. But I do plan on writing another book that's not for people in program. That's just very, very general, and I plan on framing it differently, but that just goes on my list of plans that are very slowly happening.
Thank you. Jason, you're up next.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for taking your time on the Sunday with all of us. This is super, super helpful to me. I'm brand new at this. I just started joining OA meetings a couple weeks ago.
Welcome.
Thanks. I was inspired. My brother joined a Narcotics Anonymous couple of meetings up in Chicago where he's at. And one of the things that really has motivated him are these, they give you little keychains, you know, when you hit your 30-day mm-hmm. mark. Like, and you had sort of answering the first question, talked about how, you know, when you're not using, you know, hard drugs or alcohol or whatever, like there's a clear delineation. It's black and white. And, you know, I mean, I quit smoking 31 years ago and I can say, you know, there was a hard cutoff, but how do you, I guess maybe in your own experience, define sobriety when it comes to food addiction? Or how do you, you know, I mean, where's the little keychains? You know, how does it work? Again, I'm super new, so I might be asking a question that a lot of other people already understand.
It's a great question. There are probably, you know, since I have limited time in OA, I would say, I mean, limited amount of time that I've been in OA meetings. You know, I would say I'm probably not the best person to answer that question. For me, and what I consider my own sobriety with food, it's not black and white. It's a relationship with food that is non-obsessive and non-destructive for me, you know. And that can even include things like orthorexia, where I'm so hyper focused on eating only healthy foods that, you know, that can be damaging as well. I can get burnt out and resentful and, you know, end up crashing and stuff like that. So yeah, one of the things I do think is important about, you know, food sobriety, sexual sobriety, relationship sobriety, things like that, is to actually try and make it as clear cut as possible, to sort of go into lawyer mode when you're making your plan, and just to make it as specific as possible. So you at least have a way to know, like, am I doing my plan? Am I not? But even that, I think, needs to be sort of a living document and something that changes over time, not something that you change by yourself on a whim,
right?
But, you know, something that you are open to changing and working on. I hope that answers the question.
That's super helpful. Thanks a bunch.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jason. Next up is Danny.
Hey, welcome, Jason, and all the newcomers. Jeffrey, thank you very much for your time today. I've got your book on Kindle, and this was a good reminder that I haven't finished it yet, just like a lot of other books that I have. But I'm pretty close to the end, but I'll get back to it. Wanted to thank you for saying that everyone, in your opinion, everyone is not cut out to be a sponsor. Mm. And I've been in OA for a long time, but I've never been a sponsor because I've never had the period of abstinence that, you know, long timers have suggested that that's not the best service if I'm not, I don't have what I can't give away. What do you think about me having somebody report their food to me or just kind of being an accountability buddy? Mm-hmm. But some people call that a food sponsor. So I don't want to, you know, do that. What do you think about that?
I think that'd be great. I think that would be great if you feel like you are able to listen and just be there for somebody and provide that support. I think that's great. And I'm not a big fan of having to slap a label on that. But you know, I understand that there's, you know, there's customs and stuff like that. So I would say if that's something that you find mutually helpful, I think it's fine. I think it's fine to do that.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And just kind of being a friend in recovery, I guess.
But just to also be clear about what your role is and what you're doing and what the boundaries are and this and that. And if this person starts asking you questions and saying, you know, like, what do you think about this? You can just be very comfortable saying, oh, I don't know. I would talk to some other people about that. I really think we should all like have a board we go to rather than just one sponsor. We need we're a group, you know, like a small feedback group. I think I've always found to be the most helpful for personal growth in relationship with other people, because you get multiple points of view and, you know, people can sort of, you know, everyone's sort of supporting everybody, which is why I've always preferred smaller 12-step meetings to larger ones. I'd like just a good sort of like 5-person step study is so, so helpful to me.
Thanks a lot. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thanks, Danny, for your question. And Andrea, you're up next.
Yeah, hi. Thank you very much, Jeff. I really appreciate your lens onto the whole, you know, question about the 12, you know, practicing the 12 steps. You know, you mentioned, and I like this way, the third wave of therapy being mindfulness and radical self-acceptance. For someone who's got over 30 years sobriety, this is where I'm at, right? So it's all very muddled to me in terms of, you know, we talk about meditation, we talk about mindfulness, and then we talk about radical self-acceptance. And they all sort of seem to be dropped into the meditation box, right? Mm. And I was just, you know, curious if perhaps if you would maybe delineate it a little bit and then also talk a little, you know, radical acceptance, right, is a fairly new frontier. And I was just curious about like who are you listening to?
So when it comes to radical acceptance, I mean, that particular phrase, the only place I've heard it used frequently is in the field of dialectical behavioral therapy. They use that as a tool. I don't make a big distinction between, at least the way I use it, I don't make a big distinction between radical acceptance and mindfulness. I would say radical acceptance is just a portion of mindfulness. It's the act of just being without judgment and observing whatever's going on. Observing it sort of like you're on a train watching the scenery pass by, you know, just like, there it is, there it is, there it is. That's what it is. Giving it a label if you want, a non-judgmental label, but just, yeah. And so that's me is mindfulness. Radical acceptance is part of mindfulness. And then what were some of the other things you were talking about? Like meditation? I think meditation is its whole, you know, people conflate meditation and mindfulness a lot too. And you know, I think there's a big difference there.
That's sort of what I was saying. Cause I treat, you know, meditation to me is different from mindfulness. Right. And then, you know, with this, you know, you're hearing radical acceptance a lot, mm-hmm. In the rooms, and it's just sort of like it seems to be conflating everything.
Yeah, I think radical acceptance is a good tool to use. I think it's just a portion of the overall practice of mindfulness, I think it's maybe a little bit easier to digest for a lot of people, because mindfulness itself can kind of be complicated for anyone who's not experienced it or practiced it before. I've taught some mindfulness groups, and there's often a lot of people that are like, what are you watching my thoughts? What are you like, how do you watch a thought? You know, and it's very new to them. So I like terms like radical acceptance that are a little more easy to digest, and, you know, little components of mindfulness. But yeah, when it comes to meditation, I mean, I think meditation, you can meditate and practice mindfulness. You can meditate and not practice mindfulness. You can practice mindfulness while not meditating. So there's some overlap, but they're not. Oh my God. I know someone whose sponsor pressured her to join her MLM. That is absolutely horrendous. Sorry. I just saw that in the chat. I think meditation can be a lot of different things too. You can have, you know, loving kindness meditation. You can have just relaxation meditation. You know, so I think it's important to so I have to close the chat. That was really funny. That was a good one.
I get it. Thank you very much.
No.
It's just that, like, and I go, oh my God. And then there's loving kindness meditation, right? Yeah. It's just, I never feel like I'm quite meditating, you know, my approach to meditation, even if I'm, you know, it's like, okay, I can do quiet or I can do all these other things. Right. So I just appreciate the opportunity to ask questions.
Yeah. I'm a fan of starting with mindfulness meditation. Start with mindfulness meditation. It's very simple. It's, you know, you're just sitting and picking an object of focus and focusing on it. And when thoughts and feelings come in, which they will every half second, and that's okay, you notice them and then draw your attention back. That's what I like to start with. And then, you know, if people find that they want to move on to other things or, you know, practice loving kindness, then fine. But, you know, I think it should start with a formal sitting mindfulness meditation. And then when you understand how mindfulness works and what that mechanism is of turning inward and going, oh, this is happening, then bringing that just into your daily life, I think, is great. Mindful eating, mindfully walking from one building to the next, you know, so.
Great. Thank you. And we will end with our last question from Janine.
Hi, thank you so much for this presentation. I am one of those OCD people that read most of the book last night and this morning. And
thank you.
Because that's part of my little twist in compulsivity. My question is, you know, and this may, it may be a question for you, Jeffrey, I don't know, but it seems like in the secular groups, there isn't as much structure. There are more books like this one and this one. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how do you find a sponsor that uses whatever secular approach there is? You know, it's a little frustrating even to find a sponsor that then might ascribe to this one, or maybe they decided they use a different method. And, you know, is it just important to just get started and, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's important. And I think, you know, ultimately the skill that's the most important is learning how to create your own structure in your life. And one of the things with my book, like if somebody reads my book or they read, you know, any of the other books and they find a set of steps that works for them, I think it's okay to say, hey, I want to do it this way, you know, and find somebody who's just going to sort of look through it and be like, okay, yeah, I can do it with you this way, or we can do it together or something like that. I think that's fine.
And if they're too rigid to do that, then you just keep looking for someone else. Perhaps.
Yeah.
And would you suggest partnering with someone, since there's such a shortage in both traditional and let me just say this too. I've been in and out of the room since 1987, and I couldn't stomach the God thing. So this has been refreshing, and I'm back into physical recovery, but it's the character development, which is what drove me back in, you know, the food issue. Yes, that's, I'm very well aware when I'm in recovery and not in recovery in that regard, but it's the character development is why I'm back. Mm-hmm. And I just want to get on with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. I think it's fine to do that in whatever way works for you. And yeah, it's, you know, structure is a double-edged sword, you know, in some ways it can be really necessary. And then in some ways it can be sort of stifling and not allow you to work the program in your own individual way that best suits you. And so, yeah. And that's hard for newcomers too. You know, if, for people who've maybe been around for a little while, it's a little easier to be like, okay, I'm going to take, you know, I'm going to be assertive and ask for what I need and find the people that, you know, are going down the same path as I am. For newcomers, it's tough, I think. So yeah, it's not an easy, I don't think there's an easy answer to that, unfortunately.
Thank
other,
you.
Other than for everybody to use my book all the time.
That's a great ending. And I just wanted to say again, thank you so much, Jeffrey, for your insights. They have been incredibly helpful. And we really appreciate you coming to speak at this meeting.
Thank you for joining us today. If you'd like to support our efforts, please visit secularovereaters.org and consider making a donation.